This program is made available to you every other month by Princeton Insurance, a Milmick company. We hope that this provides you with valuable information regarding national issues and important trends in the field of healthcare risk management. Comments regarding this program should be referred to Princeton Risk Management at 866-794-7475. Hospitals and ambulatory sites learn how an obsession with eliminating waste and defects at Toyota can make patient care safer.
Using lean principles, Toyota talks about error-proofing processes so that errors don't occur in the first place. You know, actually identifying them, seeing them before they ever reach the patient.
And a look at the legal ins and outs of curbside consults in the digital age. These stories and more on Resource, a news program with the latest issues in patient safety and healthcare risk management. Now available online at rmf.harvard.edu. Resource is produced 6 times a year by CRECO RMF and the Harvard Medical System. Information about receiving automatic podcasts and risk management CME is at the end of this program. When it comes to curbside consults, patient care still benefits from the informal interaction, and physicians still face some liability risk that they should manage. But as Boston defense attorney Ellen Epstein Cohen of Adler, Cohen, Harvey, Wakeman, Gugazian tells us in this month's legal report, the risk has changed. Managing editor Tom Agello recently interviewed Epstein Cohen about curbside consults in the digital age.
Ellen, thank you for joining us. Let's start by saying what we mean when we talk about curbside consults.
Okay. The general understanding of what a curbside consult is an informal interaction between physicians or other healthcare providers in which one physician asks for advice or input on how to handle a particular patient issue where they're not in the presence of the patient, where the person who the doctor is speaking to doesn't necessarily know or has never met the patient. It's just an informal exchange between colleagues trying to help make treatment decisions.
So what are some of the special considerations when this interaction takes place electronically?
I think that's perhaps the most important question on this issue right now in the electronic age, where doctors communicate with each other by email so much, and there are really good reasons for doing it. At the same time, if you receive an email that asks you a specific medical question, if you want to protect yourself, the best way to do it is to make clear that your answer is a general answer that is not intended to apply to any particular patient, because you have a limited amount of information that is presented to you, and you're providing a general answer in response without meeting a patient, seeing a patient, examining a patient, having the necessary medical history and additional details and information about that patient. So if you choose to answer a general question with a general answer and you qualify it that way, you'll be much better off. Once your name gets in a particular patient's chart as a consultant or someone that advised the treating about the care and the decisions involved in the care, then you've gotten yourself an invitation into a later lawsuit.
What if somebody does give advice during a curbside consult and is not terribly explicit with the physician that they're giving it to, and that particular physician writes it down in the medical record? And lo and behold, 2 years later, they're both found in the midst of a lawsuit. Is there anything that the requesting physician can do after that suit's already been filed so they don't throw their colleagues under the bus?
Once they make the ill-advised decision to put their colleague's name in the chart, there isn't a whole lot they can do to unring that bell, if you will. The important thing to understand is that for a plaintiff, which is a patient in a civil suit is a plaintiff, for a plaintiff to succeed in bringing any medical negligence claim, they first have to prove, the first element of negligence is a doctor-patient relationship. So the defense of the doctor who was consulted informally would be, I never met this patient. I never saw this patient. I never examined this patient. I never made a note in this patient's chart. I never had any information about who this patient even was. I didn't know this patient's name. And so the argument, the legal argument would be that there was no doctor-patient relationship and therefore no duty ran from the consultant to the patient. But that doesn't mean they won't have to stay in the lawsuit and fight that and prove it. So if the goal is not to get into the lawsuit in the first place, then you don't want your name appearing in some patient's chart where you don't know the patient and you've never been involved directly in patient care.
How would you advise to have that conversation?
Well, the first most important thing would be to say, if you'd like me to see your patient and evaluate your patient and give advice, send me a referral. In other words, make this go through the formal route of getting me involved in the patient's care. And also, you know, I think there are very practical reasons for doing that. It can't hurt in a verbal face-to-face interchange or telephone interchange to say, you know, I'm not giving advice on this particular patient and please don't, you know, include me in the patient's chart. I don't know this patient. In an email, certainly you would have it clear. You could use your standard language, your disclaimer language that says, you know, this is just a general answer to your general question, and please don't construe this as medical advice for any particular patient.
What about when the other physician is out of state? Maybe you were good friends, and one person moved to Michigan and says, oh, I know who I can contact. I'm going to contact Joe in Massachusetts. Is there anything different that they should be taking into consideration?
Well, absolutely. And the question is, if you give medical advice with regard to a particular patient over the internet to a patient who's not in your state, the question becomes, are you practicing medicine without a license in that state? So if you make clear that you're not giving patient advice or treatment, you're just trying to answer a general medical question, that would tend to make it clearer that you're not practicing medicine in that form.
And anecdotally, any trends you've identified, more aggressive action by plaintiffs to bring that into a case against a doctor?
I actually haven't seen it increasing. I would say I've seen it decreasing, and that's because of education and awareness. So the lawsuits that I've seen are there when the doctor's name gets into the record. And so I know that sounds overly simplistic, but if we can educate providers, it's good to get consultation from your colleagues, but it's not only unfair, but really not good medicine to include a doctor's name in a chart where you've never made a formal referral. Then we will have gotten really far in trying to eradicate this as a basis for liability for the informal curbside consultant.
Thank you. Ellen Epstein Cohen is with Adler Cohen, Harvey Wakeman, and Gugazian of Boston. For Resource, I'm Tom Agello.
At Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Dorothy Goulart works year-round to help departments and clinical units do more and less at the same time. Taking a page from Toyota's manufacturing model, Goulart is among a growing army of healthcare professionals working to drive out waste and inefficiency in the healthcare industry using lean processes. Lean is a method for fixing system flaws by using some key concepts. First, the frontline people at the point of care are involved to identify problems and potential solutions or countermeasures. Then they examine every step in a single process or pathway across multiple settings and professional disciplines, called a value stream. Select specific metrics to measure success, assess the intervention against the metrics, and repeat the process routinely to continue to root out inefficiency and waste. Standardizing processes is also an important lean concept. According to advocates, lean promises to cut costs, add to staff satisfaction, and reduce medical errors at the same time. Dorothy Goulart.
We can improve the way that we provide care. Toyota talks about error-proofing processes. so that errors don't occur in the first place. So it's really very applicable to looking at various processes proactively to see ways that we can keep errors from ever occurring in the first place, or trapping them, you know, actually identifying them, seeing them before they ever reach the patient.
As the Director of Performance Improvement at Brigham and Women's Center for Clinical Excellence, Goulart has overseen the use of Lean for a variety of projects. Driving out waste and improving efficiency frees clinicians to do more of what they are uniquely trained for. Goulart says these principles that increase efficiency can also mean reduced nosocomial infections, fewer drug errors, and other patient safety benefits.
We've done similar work using Lean principles looking at medication reconciliation. So how might a physician at the end of an office visit with a patient actually have a process of making sure that what the patient says they're taking for medicines match the list of medications that's in the patient's medical record?
At LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City, Dr. Terry Klemmer is Director of Critical Care Medicine. Dr. Klemmer was part of a research project that applied Lean to his ICU. They still use Lean principles, but he identified some challenges.
Some things are very successful. The routine task of delivering potassium or running a ventilator, ambulating patients according to protocols and things, those have been very successful. We struggled more with things that cross into other departments, although we're making good strides right now. But for sepsis, for example, where you have to coordinate the emergency department, which is an integral part of this, along with the laboratory and the pharmacy and everybody to get it done, those have been much, much more difficult because we cross into territories where they're not as committed.
A key concept in Lean is that the process is embedded throughout the organization. In addition to the jobs they were hired to do, staff get trained in identifying problems in real time, designing metrics for improvement, coming up with countermeasures, and repeating the process. Dr. Zev Neuwirth is Vice President of Quality and Innovation for Atrius Health, a multi-group primary care practice network in the Boston area. Dr. Neuwirth was able to use some early small-scale successes with Lean to show senior leadership the value. Now it's starting to spread at Atrius.
You can just keep on doing process improvement after process improvement, but if it's not connected to your middle management level and those goals, and if it's not connected to your senior management level and the goals that are there, it's really not going to do much good. And so what we've done is we've created an entire kind of operating platform, if you will, that goes from the top of the organization to the front line of care. And at each level, there are metrics, the so-called five True North metrics, and there's literally a cascade and a linking of the metrics, and to make sure that we're all working in alignment. That is a radically different approach, which very, very few places are aware of, much less doing.
Dr. Neuwirth has used Lean for a number of safety projects at Atrius. He says that clinicians can be skeptical, but they quickly learn that Lean is more than the flavor of the month. Dr. Neuwirth says the highest use of Lean will often lead to dramatic changes in work life that actually make providing care more rewarding. He points to efforts in the orthopedics department at one of his practice sites.
When you walk into orthopedics now at our Kenmore practice, you'll see in the orthopedics department two or three whiteboards up on the wall. If you come at 8:30 in the morning and at 3:30 in the afternoon every single day, Monday through Friday, you'll walk into a team huddle. So every morning and every afternoon they have a team huddle. And every morning and every afternoon, they review the metrics, these balanced scorecard metrics, and they go over each one of them to see how they've done that day. And then they go and look at the review of the week and see how they're trending in terms of over time, if they're getting better or worse or staying the same with these metrics. And they also then move to a problem board. So if they're not getting the metrics, or if they're not improving on any metrics, they actually do root cause analysis and they figure out what's going wrong and how to fix it quickly. And so you're walking into a work environment that is a real learning organization.
Goulart says that at the Brigham, a number of skeptics have become converts to Lean, and even its strongest advocates after being involved. They see that their own ideas for what's wrong and how to fix it are respected, that they get to set the goals and implement their own changes, and are supported by leadership. Goulart and the Brigham use a healthcare consulting arm of General Electric, GE Healthcare, for help implementing Lean at the hospital. Linda Baselis-Bush is the consulting manager for GE Healthcare Performance Solutions, which has worked with institutions across the country and the UK. At the Brigham, Lean takes the form of four-day rapid cycle style improvements, one-day workouts for a specific problem, and Lean training classes for individual leaders. But the long-term goal is for as many people to use Lean as often as possible.
Especially with Lean, it's not something you can just learn in the classroom. You can learn some of the fundamentals, the theories of it, but there's no match for actually going out, participating in a project, and seeing the results of the staff being involved, identifying what the problems are, identifying what the potential solutions are, trying them out right away, seeing the results. But the bigger picture and where you see the bigger impact is that it's on a higher level. It's a way to continuously address certain areas of opportunity and continually look at ways to improve more and more.
According to Bacellus Bush, those victories are important to show management and clinical leaders that the benefits of lean process improvement is worth the cost and staff time. Leadership buy-in is a critical success factor to bring down the work silos that allow process breakdowns to go unnoticed.
In Lean, they talk about value streams. And so a value stream could be the service that's provided to a patient, and this patient could go through several different departments in their whole journey through to get this one healthcare service. To get the attitude of the collaboration between the different departments within a hospital to see that there's a bigger picture here is a big challenge. It's a huge challenge. And I think Lean is a good way to address that, though, because there are many ways to be able to come up and look. And for anyone who's done any kind of value stream mapping, it's a way to look at the services that are delivered across all of those departments and be able to see the interactions and then eventually identify the waste and how to make it better across all of those.
That's been the experience of Dr. Neuwirth's work at Atrius as well. After introducing the Lean methodology, residents began asking to stay and establish their careers there. Dr. Neuwirth says that hadn't happened in 30 years.
There were probably multiple factors, but the biggest thing we did and the thing that distinguished it from everywhere else we were working was implementing Toyota Lean. One of the Toyota masters that I'd been speaking to about this and mentioning to him, and he said, you know, the way you improve people's morale is that you allow them to have a goal, you set a target and you set a goal, and you give them the skills and the tools to actually reach that goal. There's probably nothing more satisfying for a human being to actually create a goal and achieve it. And that, for me, is really at the heart of the Toyota Lean methodology.
You're listening to Resource, a news program of current issues in patient safety and healthcare risk management. Every other month, Resource provides timely analysis and ideas for improvement to members of the healthcare, insurance, and legal professions. Podcasts of this and other audio programs from CRICO RMF and the Harvard System are available at www.rmf.harvard.edu. The following case abstract is based on closed claims in the Harvard system. Some details have been changed to protect identities.
A 21-year-old female presented to the emergency department about an hour after spontaneous rupture of membranes at 39 weeks. She was evaluated in the labor and delivery unit by the nurse midwife on call and sent home with the advice to return when her contractions were closer together. About 2 hours later, the patient did return to labor and delivery and was reevaluated by the same obstetrical provider. The patient's cervix was 1 centimeter dilated, 90% effaced, and the fetal head at negative 1 station. The fetus was evaluated with electronic fetal heart monitor for 13 minutes. The nurse midwife sent the patient home early in the afternoon with instructions to return if her contractions did not increase by 7 p.m. The patient returned by wheelchair to labor and delivery at 6:45 p.m., grunting and bearing down. Her cervix was 9 centimeters dilated, 100% effaced, and fetal head at positive 1 station. EFM revealed a fetal heart tracing with marked variability in the baseline heart rate, fluctuating between 120 and 180, and notable for repeated decelerations to 90 beats per minute. The patient labored for about 2 more hours before delivery occurred, during which time there were persistent, recurrent, deep, variable decelerations to 80 to 90 beats per minute. The nurse midwife delivered a baby boy at 9:01 p.m. with EPGARs of 1 at 1 minute and 3 at 5 minutes. The baby was transferred to a tertiary care facility where he experienced seizure activity. A brain MRI confirmed findings consistent with hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. The baby developed additional symptoms of profound, permanent neurological deficits, including blindness and a severe seizure disorder. The patient's parents sued the nurse midwife and two labor and delivery nurses, alleging that mismanagement of labor and delivery in the aftermath led to profound neurological defects of the baby. The legal defense was compromised by the loss of the EFM strips, and the case was settled against the nurse midwife for more than $1 million. To discuss the risk management and patient safety aspects of this case, Dr. David Acker joins us now. Dr. Acker is Chief of Obstetrics at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Acker, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Where do we first start to see problems in this case?
So a variety of questions comes to mind. First, in whatever community hospital this is there a policy that clearly states what fetal heart rate abnormalities mandate consultation with a physician? Second, in whichever community hospital this is, has there been adequate and recurring educational processes so that people can recognize, quote, repeated decelerations to 90 beats per minute, etc.? Third, is there a backup for the midwives in the hospital?
So let me interrupt you there. When we talk about those kind of communication and collaboration issues, what are we looking for in a sort of an ideal setup? And including, if there had been nurses or anyone else who had did recognize those problems, activating a chain of command.
Okay. Well, you bring up actually two different problems. Let's take an easier one, the easy one first. It's the situation where everyone is actually in agreement that something's wrong and something should be done. Well, all of those policies and protocols need to be put in place by the leadership of the midwifery program, the leadership of the obstetrics program, and the leadership of the administrative program that is devoted to maternal and child health. So there is a regularly reviewed physician midwife guidelines and policies, and they are aimed primarily at patient safety, not pride in being a midwife or autonomy of the physician to stay home as long as possible. Human beings being human beings, there's not always going to be agreement. And then there needs to be a corollary policy that deals with discord. And discord means discord amongst any person who is on the labor and delivery floor. That person could be the most junior nurse, and her opinion counts on an equal level with the most senior midwife or physician. The team must be concordant, or the discordant policy needs to be operationalized and things move up the chain of command.
Let's talk about the fetal monitoring strips. They ended up being an issue in the defensibility of the case.
They end up, as far as I'm concerned, being an issue for two reasons. Let's take the least controversial. So turning to the current clinical guidelines for obstetric providers, page 5, institutional responsibility. Each institution shall accommodate for preserving all electronic fetal monitoring tracing with special consideration and allocation of resources to assure permanent and secure preservation of fetal monitor tracings for all babies born with a 5-minute APGAR score of 4 or less. In my experience in medical legal situations in Massachusetts, the statement that I have heard made in court by the judge is chilling, because my impression is most of the time these things are lost just due to carelessness. However, that's not what the judge tells the jury. The judge specifically tells the jury that if they lost it, you can assume that would be the proof that they were negligent. The second issue with the fetal monitor interpretation is obviously made difficult for me because I don't have the fetal monitor to look at. But nonetheless, looking at the description of the tracing, one could conclude it is definitely not a normal tracing. And if there were appropriate guidelines, the guidelines would state that this is the type of fetal monitor tracing for which consultation is necessary. So either there is no guideline in this hospital and they should have it, or there is a guideline and it's been violated, then you just leave this up to the individual hospital and the professional discipline within the system. Or, in my experience, a very common problem, which I can call the one more push attitude. All of the professionals know something wrong is going on, but they feel, for whatever reason, one more push and the baby will be delivered. And so people encourage the patient to push, and the baby is not delivered with the next push. So then people say, it's just one more push. And as amazing as this is, people can keep on saying this for a half hour to 45 minutes, always thinking the next push will be the delivery. That is a trap that I have seen good people get into, and for which I don't have an immediate solution. It's almost human nature, and we have to devise systems that counteract human nature. So the monitor tracing's absence dooms the whole thing. The controversy, and there must have been controversy in interpreting and consulting, almost dooms it. And in the end, sadly, we're not talking about a case that is doomed. We're talking about a baby who is doomed. And that's what makes this really tragic.
And that was Dr. David Acker, chief of obstetrics at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. For Resource, I'm Tom Augello.
Medical facilities continue to feel pressure to incorporate electronic information tools to improve efficiency and reduce risks in clinical processes. To help prevent drug errors, for example, electronic prescribing is increasingly available, even in ambulatory care settings. The federal government is providing incentives to begin electronic prescribing in ambulatory care, where most prescriptions are written. Manufacturers of prescribing systems have sought to meet market demand to add software that goes beyond just automating a process, to incorporate intelligence that actually helps prescribers make better decisions. This can mean an audio alert when a clinician attempts to prescribe an unconventional dose or a combination of drugs that is usually and widely contraindicated. When confronted with a noisy bell or unpleasant alarm, a prescriber can usually override these alerts. Dr. Saul Weingart is Vice President of Quality Improvement and Patient Safety at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Dr. Weingart recently co-authored a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine that looked at the rate at which clinicians override alarms that go off when using electronic prescribing.
There's a widespread perception among clinicians that alerts occur too much. There's this concept of alert fatigue, there's this concept of alert overload. The idea is that when you turn on these electronic systems, they bombard the clinician with information that may not be clinically useful or relevant, and that rather than doing good, they're actually intruding on clinical care and getting in the way of efficient practice.
Dr. Weingart's research showed that physicians overrode the alerts 9 out of 10 times. But Dr. Weingart says that's not the end of the story.
The question that begs is, if docs override 90% of the alerts and accept only 9% or 10%, are we getting any benefit from that? In other words, what is the cost, utilization, and patient safety benefit of a relatively small number of cases where the docs change their perspective? So we've done some work on that, and we've tried to model that. And what we've found is that, in fact, there is a patient safety benefit, that we do prevent injuries, that we do reduce utilization, and in turn, cost, principally from hospitalizations.
The question is whether that benefit is worth the cost, both in dollars and in physician time and mental distraction. Weingart's team is also looking at whether medical professionals who reject a prescribing alert do something differently to improve safety as a result, after they override the alarm.
So, for example, if I get an alert and it tells me there's an interaction between two drugs, but both of them are needed, for example, a blood thinner and an antibiotic, then I might still go ahead and prescribe the medications because they're needed, and at the same time, arrange for the patient to come back a little earlier for follow-up. or arrange for early blood tests or provide some counseling of some kind or another. And our preliminary research suggests that, in fact, those alerts are triggering actions by clinicians that is above and beyond what we'd expect from the override rates themselves.
Dr. Weingart doesn't want doctors and manufacturers of electronic prescribing devices to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Given the existence of some patient safety and utilization benefit, an effort to make alerts work for doctors is worthwhile, especially considering the risks that lurk behind the alarms.
We know that the rate of adverse drug events in ambulatory care is about 1 in 4. That means about 1 in 4 patients over the course of 3 months who receives a prescription will have some symptom related to the medication. Not that many of them are serious, and a minority of them are preventable, but many of them are ameliorable, meaning that the severity and duration of the symptom could be reduced if something was done differently, if the doctor made a better decision, or if the doctor acted on patient information, or if the patient communicated the information.
Despite growing federal pressure, electronic prescribing is not widespread in ambulatory care. Massachusetts has one of the highest penetration rates, but it's well under 30%. Organizations that have shown the most success in balancing the number of alerts and the benefits tend to be large academic hospitals and their affiliated ambulatory sites. Dr. Weingart says that Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, for example, was able to tweak its proprietary software systems to suppress some alerts and drive the override rate down to 70% or so. They did this by creating a tiered system of alarms, with only the most serious problems triggering an alert.
And ultimately, what we'd really like to do is be able to tie these electronic alerts into more information that's in an electronic health record. So, for example, if a patient's on an aspirin and an ACE inhibitor, that will fire an alert because those drugs both can have an effect on the kidney. However, if you have heart failure or heart disease, those are two indicated drugs that you want to have together. In fact, it improves clinical outcomes if you have those drugs on board at the same time. So if we could design an alert system that would suppress alerts when those drugs are used in combination in patients who have on their problem list heart failure, then we'd be much farther along.
Now, with some additional developments in healthcare patient safety and risk management, here's managing editor Tom Agillo and this month's news briefs.
A new study in the Archives of Internal Medicine suggests widespread shortcomings in telling patients about abnormal test results in the ambulatory setting. The study by Casolino and colleagues reviewed thousands of patient charts and found that the rate of failure to inform patients was more than 7%. Better rates were associated with a practice's use of common and simple processes for managing test results. 14% of hospital pages went to the wrong physician in another study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in July 2009. Of those misdirected pages at two academic medical centers, nearly half were either urgent or emergencies. Most went to doctors when they were off duty. And, according to Health Information Network SureScripts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts leads the nation in electronic prescribing, a process considered especially effective in minimizing drug errors. Auditing its own data, the nation's largest prescription network noted that 20% of eligible prescriptions in Massachusetts were routed electronically from doctors to pharmacies in 2008. I'm Tom Agillo for Resource.
This has been Resource. Our program is produced bi-monthly by Crico RMF in the Harvard Medical System as an educational service for Princeton Insurance, a Milmick company. Comments regarding this audio program may be directed to Princeton Risk Management at 866-794-7475.